Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. As has been said, this show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. This is a no-holds-barred show. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight, my guest is Kevin J. Howard, who is an outstanding author and an award-winning screenwriter. He is actually writing a screenplay for my latest book, Occam's Razor Revisited, which will be out in print form within the next couple of weeks from Balboa Press. Kevin was born in Mission Viejo, California, and moved to Seattle at the age of 21. He now lives in a town that I asked him to pronounce, and I've already forgotten the pronunciation. What is it, Kevin?
It's a Puyallup.
Puyallup, okay. He hand-wrote his first novel in the fifth grade and has been writing ever since. His first published novel, Faithful Shadow, is a return to the classic horror novel. Kevin's second novel, Precipice, The Beginning, recently won the Reader's Favorite Silver Medal in Horror and is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. The sequel, Precipice, The Retrieval, was released in May of 2013, and he looks forward to publishing his next novel, Closed Cell, early next year, is it, Kevin? It says early 2014.
Yeah, 2015.
Okay.
Yeah, I felt a little behind on that one.
No problem. I'm just having a hard time conceiving that we're moving into 2015. That's amazing. Since writing Closed Cell, he's completed four additional horror novels that will soon be published, including the long-awaited third novel in the Precipice series. For the past 3 years, Kevin has been writing screenplays with fantastic success. In that short time, he has completed 7 screenplays, 4 of which are award-winning, and 6 which have been requested for review by some of the largest production companies in Hollywood. He is now working as lead writer for Laurel Leaf Screenwriting Services, a company created to adapt novels and ideas into feature-length screenplays. And you've already heard him, but let me introduce him again. Kevin, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks, David.
Good.
Thanks for having me.
Good. Well, it's a pleasure. You know, I have guests come from some of the most unusual places. I don't have to search out too many. People just come into my life, and they seem like they would be very interesting people. And, of course, when I met you, I thought, there is a guy that I want to have on my show. And so here we are a couple of weeks later. But thank
like
you for agreeing to do it.
I like to think
yeah.
I'm a little interesting. That's good.
Well, Kevin, when did you start writing? It says that you wrote your first novel in fifth grade, and that is so impressive.
Well, it was, I remember it very clearly. I was in the fifth grade, one of my favorite teachers. She really inspired creativity, so it was a good year for that. And for some reason, I went into my dad's room, and I took Stephen King's Salem's Lot off his shelf. And that's what I did my book report on. My teacher was a little surprised because at fifth grade it was kind of a, Salem's Lot is not the typical, you know, it's not Ralph S. Mouse. So
yeah, right.
Yeah, it was a little surprised, but at that young age, when I read those characters about how human they weren't just like, you know, Robbity Bunny bouncing around. They had real emotions, and I thought, wow, I could write that. That's interesting. And it really sparked something in me. And a few weeks later, my best friend who's in the class is a really amazing artist. His name's Justin. He and I started writing a short story that we'd give to all the kids like once a month. And we made our own little newsletter, and it just sparked from there.
Well, that's
I guess that's
cool.
When I caught the writing bug.
Well, you know, it's. I think that for somebody that becomes a writer, those seeds are planted very early, and I think it's amazing to have written a novel when you were in the fifth grade. I tried my hand at a novel when I was much younger, but gave up on it after a couple of pages. And I never dreamed that I would be writing until after I retired. So mine has been a slightly different journey. What else have you done along the way? When did you start writing full time?
I didn't start writing as a full time author until 2012. It actually worked out very well. My wife and I thought, well, I could either go back to work at a job I don't like doing because it's not writing, or I could stay home and help with the kids and write at the same time and do that full time. And it's been working out really well so far. I never met, even with all day to write, though, my family comes in and says, okay, it's time to stop writing. You know, come down and be with the family. Even with that much time, there's still just not enough time.
Well, you know, it's wonderful there. I mean, time is certainly of the essence, and we need to make the best of the time that we have for whatever reason. And so often we need to set priorities in order to get accomplished what we need to do. I'm just curious as to how you were able to make the leap and earn a living at writing, because that is something that so many people dream of and very few actually realize.
Well, I will say it's not a... one of my favorite scenes from Kiss the Girls, the movie, if not from the book, is when he says, wow, an award-winning novelist, you must be rich. And Morgan Freeman goes, not yet. it's a wide misconception, but it is true. They say only, I forget, 1 or 2% of all authors can actually stay home and function day to day off the income they make. And I think the only way for someone who doesn't have a major publisher, someone like myself, to make a living at it is to network, get your name out there, make good friends, and just have something that people want. And luckily, I'm able to write both novels and screenplays, which was complete, to be honest, a big surprise for me, because four years ago, I didn't even know what a screenplay looked like.
How did you happen to get into writing screenplays? And how did you learn about the process involved?
That's kind of a fun story. I had a literary agent, and she was a very nice person. She was in Boston. I didn't feel like she was giving my ideas the right nurturing, the right, you know, placement in the organization. She was talking to the right publishers, but I was like, yeah, she's not there for me, and it's not moving along. And then I came up with an idea that she said, you know, that just doesn't work. It's not plausible. And in my mind, I'm thinking, how can an idea not be plausible? How are Transformers plausible, right? Big machines in New York. I mean, come on, right? So I actually parted ways with her, and I said, this idea is too big for a book. I'm going to learn how to write a screenplay. I read two books. I sat down, and I'm not kidding, a month later, I had the screenplay. It needed to be written. And that screenplay, which it's my baby. I love it. It's Identical Opposites, which I love because it's an oxymoron title, same amount of letters. It looked great on a screen. And basically, it's about a man who marries his own brother without knowing it because at a young age, his identical twin brother was given up for adoption after a sexual, not a sexual, after a malform in his genitalia. And the doctor suggested to have him turned into a girl at the time, and his father was disgusted and gave him up. So it's a revenge.
Oh, my.
You'll find out. Oh, it's like the Crying Game times 10. The twist, the end. Oh, I don't want to go into the end, but I submitted it to Las Vegas, and I was right away a finalist in the 2012 Film Festival on the very first thing I ever wrote.
Wow.
It just had to be written, you know? I just knew it had to be. And I didn't gloat to my agent. I didn't call her and say, na-na-na-na-na-na. But I was very proud that I took a chance on what I felt was right and did it anyway and didn't just listen to someone who I figured was, you know, knew what she was talking about because she's my agent at the time. I did it anyway. I'm very proud I did. And now I'm doing it all the time.
Well, I think that's a really important point to make to anybody that has a novel idea, that has faced rejection, that is insecure about their idea, that, you know, when inspiration comes along, it needs to be honored, I believe. And it sounds like you certainly did that, believed in yourself, and did what you needed to do to turn it into something that had a lot of merit to it. So that's great.
Well, I think the number one quality for any great artist of any kind is confidence. I mean, when you walk into an office, and I myself, with all the pitch sessions that I've done in front of big-time executives, you know, they're just people too. And when you sit down in front of them, they don't really want to hear the long details of your idea. They don't want to hear how it's different. They want to know that you believe in it so much that you're going to give them a great product. And they're really buying you. You know, it's like when an author, when they buy your book, you know, every review was about you because those are your words. You're talking to them directly. And I think that's very important to show that confidence.
I think that,
to show that, you know. Oh, go ahead.
No. You finish your thought, please.
Oh, no, even when I read your novel, you know, I could, and that's why, you know, adapting it, I try to do it in your words because I can see where you're coming from with your emotion and your language, and I'm reading your confidence, I'm reading your emotion, I'm reading, you know, and I think that's very important, and I think any good artist only moves forward if they put that into their idea or project. And that's why, like you said, I always tell authors, I get emails all the time saying, my idea's like this, but yeah. I said, no. All ideas that you have, if you develop them, if they're coming from you, it might be the next new thing. If 50 people reject it, but one person says, that is the greatest thing I've ever seen, look what you've just done. I'm always a very big advocate for spreading new ideas or authors finding that confidence in themselves.
That's wonderful. Well, what attracted you to the horror genre? I mean, you talked about doing a report on Salem's Lot when you were in the fifth grade. Were you a horror fan way back as a young child?
You know... After I watched Aliens for the first time, and then my sister hid in my bed, and then when I laid down and she grabbed me and scared me to death, I kind of had I enjoyed the thrill of horror. But to be honest, and I have to say this, it's a little upsetting when you want to be an author, and a lot of people say, oh, you're horror. And a lot of times I find that the next book I want to write is a young adult drama. Or a mystery. In fact, my next book to come out, it's a sci-fi thriller, and then I have a young adult drama that's fully outlined. It's even my horror novel, Close Cell, that I have two books in that series already completed. It's, I don't like to think of it as horror because I look at it like it's a real drama about a man that's just divided. Yes, there's a lot of stuff going on because we have demons running around, and that is pretty scary. But I never look at a book as just being one specific genre. So I'd like to say, yeah, I'm horror, but I like to put a finger here and there. I like to go into drama and suspense and thriller. I have not a spy thriller, but an idea I'm developing about from an old job I used to do with insurance. I know it doesn't sound fun, but it will be.
But, how do your ideas come to you?
Oh, that is okay. That is the weirdest part. A lot of people kind of curious, like, where did you come up for? Now, Faithful Shadow is probably the only one I can't say this for, because I worked in Yellowstone National Park, and the park inspired a lot of the novel. That's actually probably the only novel I've ever written that is directly linked to something I can say, oh, it came from right there. All other ideas just kind of hit me like a bolt of lightning. The Precipice series, I couldn't even begin to tell you where any of that came from. Just out of the blue, all of it at one time, like watching a movie in your mind. It's amazing. And I think that's a lot of times people say your books read very, very visually, as if I'm watching it on the screen. And I say when I write it, I am kind of watching it on the screen. I can see it in my mind, and I'm just basically dictating to the reader what I'm seeing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that sounds crazy or not. I hope not.
No, it doesn't. That's how it works for me, too. I believe that I am an instrument, and that whatever comes to me passes through me and just goes automatically onto paper. It comes from pure inspiration. I don't contrive. I don't have any preconception of where the book's going to go. Actually, when I write a book, I rarely do any outline. I just go with it and go with the flow. And, yeah, sometimes I think of some elements that I want to have in the book, and I have to try to figure out where they're going to come into play and how I'm going to and I need to make notes to myself about situations that I need to resolve. But for the most part, I just go with the flow. I don't know about you.
A lot of times I do. In fact, the only reason I do have to have an outline, and I think because with my brain, I'm like Homer Simpson and, you know, oh, blue car, you know, or squirrel from Up, you know, you just get so distracted. I might go in between projects and stuff. I do have to go off an outline, but my outlines are very, very brief, just a brief paragraph. And then the rest is, like you said, it's free writing. It just happens. In fact, you said two things that I'd really like to kind of comment on, because I agree with them so much. When you said an instrument, I know this sounds kind of unusual to some, but when I'm typing and I'm in a really good flow, and those fingers, they're just on the keyboard. You're not even looking at the keyboard. It's like you are playing an instrument. You look as if you're a pianist, and it's just, it's like music. And that's why I get, you know, I would like to say writing really is an art, because if you're letting it just flow through your fingers, not even looking at it, you are creating a piece of art. You're, you know, it's like music, and I really like how you said that, like an instrument.
Well, I feel like I'm taking dictation. I mean, I could have used the word channel, too, because I feel like I'm taking dictation from somebody else or from the creative part of my brain, however anybody wants to conceive of it. I believe that my inspiration just comes from my higher self or my source, and I just go with it. And
it's such an amazing
but I do like the word pardon me?
Well, it's such an amazing process, because, I mean, how many times will you write something and you read it later and you're like, where did I come up with that? I don't even say that.
Do you find that you've forgotten a lot of what you've written once you've put it down on paper?
A lot of what I've written sticks with me for a long time, and that's kind of the problem. Like when I said there's just not enough hours in the day, when you're working on a novel, you know, I have three more in there that want to come out. So I'm more like, I want to be like a trash compactor, pushing them forward. Like, come on, get this one out so I can work on number two and then work on number three. It's very distracting.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't remember like all of Faithful Shadow or Everywhere at Precipice, but the novels were still buzzing around in there.
Well, would you tell us about the Precipice series, what that is about, and what people can look forward to in the third novel in the series?
Oh, yeah. The Precipice series was, I've always wanted to, it sounds terrible, but I've always kind of wanted to just, you know, run amok across America like all good disaster films. But, I mean, if you read my books, I'm not overly killing. I'm not, you know, mean like that. But I like the fear of the people running and hiding and coming together. And I thought I wanted to write that. I can see that very well. So I came up with a story about a man who's helping with the Martian colony, but he's not there because he wants to be. He's there because he has to be. It was a military kind of faux pas thing. He's stuck there millions of miles from home, and he only sees his family through a satellite feed. And he's a good man, but he just got kind of screwed over. And he's working, and all of a sudden they start seeing these cracks forming across the earth. No one knows what they're from. And I wanted it to be that way. I didn't want everyone to say, like, oh, they're happening because of this. Sometimes I think a lot of horror movies and horror novels just explain it to death, and it's so formulaic that there's no thrill anymore. And I kind of think there's more fear in the unknown and discovering it later than just being told. So these cracks open up. You know, the oceans start to recede back. It's starting to rain heavy because all the evaporation's going up and the clouds are dense and it's becoming dark. And since it's becoming dark, these leathery giant creatures start coming up from the cracks. And you know, like any creature, they're not going to tell you what they're doing because they don't care. They just come up, grab you, and drag you in. And that's what they're doing. They're just collecting people. So Travis and his men, his military unit, see this happening. They're stuck on Mars. So they're like, well, wait a minute. Yeah, we can just sit here, which is great. But if Earth is destroyed, we don't get supplies. We're going to die too. So do we die slow? Or do we overtake the guards and take the supply ship and go back to Earth and get as many people as we can? And that's the book. And it's there are some, I know I'm the author, so I'm kind of, I don't know, maybe my opinion goes one way. But I have to say, I love the mental breakdown within the Martian security officers on Mars. You start to see that humans are just as nasty as the creatures people are fighting on Earth, and it gets a little dark. It gets dark.
There's some truth to that. We'll have to get into that a little bit later. Yeah. So, what is this? How does the sequel pick up?
And then the sequel is the first book is them coming up with the plan, the breakdown of the society on Mars. Andrews, who's the leader of the security officers, he starts locking the men up. They're all the miners and he starts kind of coming up with a plan to kill everybody so they can live longer. But of course, you know, they overtake and get the ship. And then the second book, I don't want to go into too much detail because I won't, you know, let everyone be surprised.
Oh, no. I don't want you to do that. I want to leave the people thirsting for going out there and getting the book Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Right. And then book two is Travis gets in contact with Annie because Annie, knowing that Transworld Incorporated, that's the company that sent Travis over, has weapons in the building, they have communications, and it's not too far from where she lives. So she and her son go there, and she gets in contact with Travis. And Travis says, stay there, we're coming to get you. And then the second book is a long trek of them going through space. They have to go to a space station where the cosmonaut has gone crazy, and that's kind of a dark scene too, to get fuel. And then they have to land. They have to go across a ruined America to go to the facility to find Annie. They rescue her. They meet all these new characters along the way. And it's just, you know, people coming together to just get away. And what's really creepy is all the creatures have started putting people in these giant metal cages, and the cages are being dragged by these giant creatures. And they're lined up in front of the cracks. I have this really dark scene, actually, where one of the creatures lifts the cage up and starts shaking the people out, and it says it's the, some kind of monster's version of human tic-tacs. that's creepy, yeah. But you know, then they're trying to escape and get back on the ship so they can take humans to the colony and get supplies, and they could at least survive a little longer. And then the third book is The Return, Precipice, The Return, and that's just them trying to get home. A lot of stuff happens on that ship with 300-400 survivors they weren't able to pre-screen before they let on board, so you've got a lot of crazy people on there that shouldn't be there. It's interesting.
When can people look forward to that book coming out?
That one, the third one, I'm only 60,000 words into that one. And,
okay.
But I'm writing it pretty quickly, so 4 months, maybe 5 months, I'm hoping.
Now, has your publisher commissioned you to keep writing in the series, or has this been your own choice?
Well, it's my own choice, yeah.
Do you anticipate it continuing beyond a trilogy?
Well, I have a book four idea, but I like where the third book ends, and I kind of, sometimes you develop characters that you just like so much you don't want to keep screwing with them, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, I don't want to leave them in their nice little corner, and then I have a trilogy for young adults I've been working on. It's like a fantasy series called the Tower series. I might start working on that as well, and I have a few horror novels I'm also working on that are outlined. So there's a lot of stuff in the works for sure. I'm just not sure which direction to go.
Well, how do characters come to you, and how do you develop them as part of the writing process?
One's like my faithful shadow character, Ranger Joe Rand, which is actually, it's my uncle's name, Joe Rand. The character's not like him, but that's his name. A lot of times people from my own life just kind of fill in a character that is similar, and I use, you know, I just kind of build off the dialogue that way. And I do take a few pages. I really break down what I see in this character, from their eyes to their hair to the way they talk, any kind of habits. I like to give them very realistic characteristics, like they might whistle or just the way they do things, how they sit down and cross one leg over the other. I think the truth is in the little details. You know, you believe people more when they're more human. You know, I don't want just the guy's over there and he comes over here. You know, he's over there and he's got, he always wears a certain color shirt or something like that. And I don't know. I just really like to break them down and make real people. And usually they're inspired by a real person I know, and never in a mean way, which is nice. I believe in good writing karma, so I don't try to do the whole, I'll get you back in my book. You know, like, you picked on me in third grade, I'll get you back.
What are your feelings about karma in general?
I am, I have been going through a divorce, and I am starting to believe, and I always have, I'm starting to believe it more, because I'm out on my own a lot more, that karma is, I just really believe in it. That's my personal belief. I think, but it's, call it whatever you will. It's, if you do nice things, if you're a good person, if you treat people well, I mean, the universe will throw good things your way. That's, I just think that's more common sense belief, really. But I can't say that, because not everybody believes that. So.
Well, you can speak your own truth, certainly, and that's what I'm encouraging you to do. I certainly believe that what goes around comes around, and that for me, in order to move forward in a positive direction, I need to stay aligned to positive influences. And as you were saying, I basically need to lead the good life if I'm going to have good things come my way. Because when I have traveled down a dark road, then things become dark for me and I'm headed away from the light and I want to live in the light. How about you?
Well, I like to say it's like positive physics, you know. It's like you do something good, it knocks something good, and it just keeps happening like that. Good things inspire good deeds. You know, there was a part in your book which I actually really believe in as well. You know, a lot of negative things can happen to you in your past. You could have even negative things in the morning, but you know, if you look at the good things that have happened, and if you look at where you're standing right now, and if you're happy with where you're standing, then you can be pretty happy with almost all the choices you've made, because they've taken you to a good spot. And I like how you said that, because I agree with that as well. But rather than dwelling on negative perceptions of yourself or projecting negative thoughts forward, if you just take a moment and just be happy with good things and say, you know, I'm standing here right now and this is nice, then all those bad things behind me, they're not that terrible because here I am.
Yes, yes.
Kind of a side tangent, I guess, but I agree with that in your book.
Well, thank you. I think it's so important not to cast judgments. We're the worst judgment casters when it comes to looking at ourselves, and we're our own worst enemy so much of the time. And it's my belief that if I am standing on good ground today, that I need to be grateful for everything that has seemed good or has seemed bad in my past, because it's brought me to my today and made me the person I am today. And I think that for me, gratitude is the key to experiencing the abundance of the universe. And that I was told by an urban mystic minister that the most important prayer that we can say is thank you. What do you think about that?
Definitely. No, I agree completely. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. If you learn how to just take simple joys out of life, you're a lot more happier. I know it sounds so simple and so kind of dopey, but you know, I like, here's an example. I go to get my kids at the bus stop every day, which is fantastic. One of my favorite parts of the day. And you know, I see a lot of people getting angry on their cell phones when they're waiting, or they're just preoccupied with other things. And I look up across the trees and I'm totally happy they're there. It's nice, a very simple thing to look at, but it's, you know, people, I think, can distract themselves and just take a moment of zen, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's good for the soul. It's good for the mind. It's
a
way to unplug. And I think, just as another side tangent, I like when I'm in a grocery store, so many people, it's almost like they're afraid to be alone. How they're on their phones or how they pick up a magazine, it's like they're almost afraid to just be with themselves. And I think that stems from lack of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know. Good vibes out there to everybody, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's get back to the writing process. How do you structure your day? I mean, you talked about how it's difficult to find enough hours in the day to do everything that you want to do. But I'm guessing that you must have some basic structure for yourself. And if not, please correct me.
Oh, no. You have to. If you're going to... If you're going to try to make any kind of a living off of your writing, you have to have a very structured work time. I mean, my children know this, but of course, being kids and being a single dad, I do have to intermix with them during the day. But typically, after I take them to the bus, I get my coffee, I sit at my desk. I do certain types of writing at different times. I have to do a little of my own every day because, to me, and I know this sounds unusual, writing is almost like an addiction. You have to do it. And if I don't do it, I get a little, I don't want to say cranky, but I get agitated because there's ideas in there. You want to get them out. And I like to do a little every day because it helps keep me moving forward and structured, and it's almost therapeutic. And I do that a little in the morning. And then, of course, you know, I work on... because I do have clients, because I work for Laura Leaf, I write in the screenplays, and I read different novels. And that's actually what I do most of my time, is reading all the different books that a lot of people send me. I don't even think I touch the main the big names anymore, which is good. I think getting a lot of, I know this side tangent from the day, but I think getting a lot of different novels from just random, all kinds of writing. I mean all kinds of writing, even a romance or a mystery thriller, just any kind of style is a nice change. I think that variety is great. And of course, I have to make myself take a lunch, because if I don't, I'll write through it. And I do it quite often, so I have to make myself take a lunch every day at like 1 o'clock. I usually work until 3 o'clock, and then I have to go get my kids. Then I just kind of goof around with outlines and just ideas I'm furthering, because I know I'm not going to get any more writing done while the kids are there watching Adventure Time and Regular Show, and I and they're jumping all around me. So yeah, but that's about every day I do that. And then Saturday and Sunday, you know, I say I try to take a day off, but I can't. I just usually sit on the couch and type.
Have you ever experienced writer's block?
No. I'll find as much wood in this house as I can to start knocking on it. I don't want to give myself that negative thought, no. But, no, I've never had that problem, really. Usually, if I just don't feel like doing it that day, I might put it off for an hour. But once I sit down and I just start typing something, you just transitioned into work mode, which I think is very important for an author to have a separate place to work and to start a structured routine, because it tells your brain, like, okay, we're working now. You know, let's get to work. And a lot of people think, like, oh, I'll stay home as a writer and I'll just sit in my boxer shorts on the couch and eat potato chips and type whenever I want. But if you do that, your mind gets lazy and you won't keep working.
Right, right. No, yeah. I totally agree with you on that. I have not experienced writer's block. I have experienced periods in my life where I haven't felt particularly motivated, and I've given myself a break from it and have moved in other directions because I have a lot of other things going on in my life. But my hat's off to you, and congratulations on being able to make a living at writing, and I hope that it will become a very profitable endeavor for you as you move along the path. For anybody that wants to avail themselves of your screenwriting services, how can they get in touch with you?
Oh, I am working on my own website for more advertising, but that's not ready yet. I'll have it linked through my LinkedIn. But I think for right now, I encourage anyone to find me on LinkedIn.com. It's always my name, Kevin J. Howard, because I want people to find me. You know, my name's out there. You know, on my Facebook page, anyone that wants to be a friend, I'm always friending them because everybody has something interesting to say. And I'm always telling my Facebook friends that all the time. I'm saying, thank you for being my friends, you creative people. I love hearing different things. Laurel Leaf primarily is done through LinkedIn because that's more of a business setting. That's where my email address is on there. Anyone can send me an email and ask me any questions on how it works. And you don't even have to have a book to adapt. In fact, I remember Hollywood is such a fun place. I think it was the movie Outland where they decided to make a movie based on him saying, High Noon in Space. Yes, let's make a movie. You don't need much to make a good film. You just need an idea. So if you have an idea, I could stretch it out like taffy until we have a feature film. I mean, that's something else I offer, original concepts. So it's kind of a service for everybody, really. You don't have to be in the creative industry to have a screenplay, which I think
is awesome. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. I never had considered that possibility. That really opens the doors for a lot of people who have ideas that might be able to be turned into films.
You know, one of the phrasings I use, and I myself have done this, I think everybody has, you walk into a movie, and you see, it's a good film, but when you're walking out, you say, man, I could make something better because. And it might jog a new memory, or, I mean, not a memory, a new idea, and, you know, just a normal person stretches it off into a pretty decent idea. But without, you know, understanding that, oh, I could sit down and write this, I don't have time, I don't know how to do that, it just dies away, which is really too bad because I think Hollywood could really use a lot of new ideas right now. I mean, you know, that aren't being remade from a 20-year-old movie that's coming out now. I think we could use a lot of new blood in there. So, yeah, I'd love to offer the service for anybody.
How do you account for your success? I mean, in the course of 3 years, to have completed 7 screenplays and 4 of them being award-winning, and please excuse my dog in the background. I'm sorry, I did not lock him away. And the closed door is not doing a lot to diminish his barking. But how do you account for your
Hello?
Yes, how do you account for your success with screenwriting?
You know, screenwriting is a very, very out of left field, don't know how it happened kind of thing. Like I said, when I was in Vegas giving a speech, I was standing there in front of the people and said it took me, you know, 12 years to write the screenplay. And I felt intimidated to stand in front of them and saying, I did this last month, thank you. Like they were going to beat the hell out of me. Because, you know, I never, cause, you know, not to be, I didn't mean it in a mean way. I was just like, oh, damn, you know. I don't know. It just seems so natural. So when I sat down, I took my novel, Close Cell, and I adapted it. And it was so natural to put it over there, just to slide it in, and it fits so well the way I did it, and it just seemed right, that I turned that into, let's see, it won second place at, no, it won first place at the 17th Indie Gathering Film Festival in Ohio. And it was a final, it was a top five finalist in the Fright Night Film Festival, I wish I could have gone to that too. It's a huge film convention in Kentucky. It's a convention center, thousands of people there, tons of celebrities, but I couldn't make it. And that's a bummer. That's the problem. It's not getting into the festivals. It's actually having the money to go to all of them and have fun. But it's, and that screenplay has been a finalist in at least four or five film festivals on its own. And then my third screenplay, which is actually one of my favorites, and this is a drama about a slave that, you know, is actually the culmination of an entire race in his bloodlines, and he doesn't know it. It's very romantic. He falls in love with a handmaiden, and that screenplay, the very first place I put it in, was a finalist in the Beverly Hills Film Festival, which is fantastic. That is a beautiful film.
Wow.
That's where I got to meet John Voight. And he actually gave me, I met him in the movie theater and I talked to him. He was a very nice man. And then the award ceremony is at the Beverly Hills Four Seasons, which is like, hey, you know, wow. You walk the red carpet. I'm sitting there at dinner in the front row. I don't know how I scored the front table, but I did. And, you know, I'm talking to my wife. All of a sudden someone puts their hands on me and starts giving me a shoulder massage. I look up and it's John Voight.
Oh, my.
I know, right? Like, holy crap. So, I mean, like, you know, yeah, I just, screenwriting is another, it's just fun because you just don't know what's going to happen next. It gets you into a lot of fun places, you know, and I think I like that side of it. I like, and screenwriters, they're very easy to share their ideas. They love to talk and they love to collaborate. I didn't get that as much when I went to the Miami Book Fair, and it was strange. Authors didn't talk as much, unless they were on the stage.
Hmm. That is interesting.
Nothing against authors, I'm one too, so.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I really don't. I think the reason being, a screenwriter always has to sell what he's working on to everybody. An author just, I think, sits down and does it because we're going to do it. And it's, you know, the reclusive writer, which is kind of contradictory to be reclusive and throwing your name out there. It's tough. But I think, like, when you're a screenwriter, you're constantly trying to get Hollywood people to look at it. So you're very voiced. You're very, hey, you know, you're very social. And an author, we just kind of like to sit back and let our work speak for us. That's what I think the difference is. Both
that makes sense to me.
Different. Yeah.
Well, tell us about Close Cell.
Oh, Close Cell. This book has been with me for a long time. Yeah, I actually wrote it when I was 22, so it was about 12 years ago. And it's about the Archangel Michael, who was discarded and left to wander Earth. He's very disgruntled. He cast his sword down, so as punishment, God took his sword and put it in his wrist, and he carries a scar on his wrist. So when he gets angry and engages in battle, he pulls back his hand, and it, like, kind of juts out his wrist, and that's how he fights. But he's kind of detached from all biblical associations. He just wanders around. He does psychic parties to make money, or he just manipulates people with his mind. And for boredom, he works with the Seattle Police Department or other departments as a psychic for hire because he's bored, and it gives him something to do. Only the Seattle Police Department bring him in on a case that turns out to be orchestrated by a demon that's doing a ritual to give him residency in our world. So Michael actually becomes panicked, and it turns out that the demon is like Beelzebub, and they have this great sword fight on Safeco Field as he's opening these portals to bring hell through. It's It's a fun book that shows him coming to terms with why he's there and that he's needed for this, and he's not just some loser, but he is who he is. And it's dark, but I think there's a good dash of humor, because I think even dark books need humor. Because life is not always dark. It's always everything. So that's why, like I said, I don't like to just classify horror as horror. Because, you know, people are going to laugh at things. They're going to be sad about things. You have to put a good dash of all of it in there.
Well, I think that's really interesting. Yeah.
And I wrote a second book that's completed as well. It's called The Right Hand of Solomon. It's not about zombies. It's a Michael book, a closed cell continuation. But it does deal with the dead and the gatekeepers of hell and heaven and how they're sealed. And, they have nowhere to go, so everybody's dead, even though they're walking around. And they become slaves to another demon. So that book's written, and that's a fun one, too. So, like I said, always writing. There's always series, and so, yeah.
Well, I'm really intrigued by Closed Cell. That's a book I'm going to have to get a hold of. Now, let me make sure I understand this right. The film is out. The book has been released or is coming out this next year?
Oh, no, it hasn't been published yet. In fact, I actually, this is kind of odd. The one I wrote 12 years ago, I was reading it and I didn't like it, so I rewrote the entire novel from word one a different way because I liked it. But I didn't like, and this is the odd thing. I know people, you know, they're I find this very odd. Even if I don't, you know, take courses in technique, every year my writing evolves so much. It changes every single year. So I find myself rewriting the books that I wrote years ago if they're not published. I've rewritten two novels so far, which can be a pain because Close Cell is 104,000 words. That's actually a pretty long novel.
That is a long novel, yeah.
But it had to be done a different way. I didn't like it. So now I really like it. It's and that's what the screenplay is modeled after. This is the one that I transferred over. So the screenplay and this novel go hand in hand.
It's interesting. The last two books that you talked about sounds like they have some biblical themes to them. What is your religious background?
Mine, I've never really given myself any sort of, I guess I'd have to say what's agnostic. You believe in the higher source and you believe in God, but you just don't like to sit in church kind of thing. Is that, would you say that? Or? Because I believe in everyone, you know, I believe in a spirit, just kind of, I don't know, be nice and treat everyone well, and that's what you need to do. That's my belief.
Like, well, you know, the way I feel about church is that church is wherever I'm at. And my own personal belief is that religion has done more harm than good throughout the test of time. And I think that it's the way a person leads their life that is the most important thing. And different guests that I've had on the show have come from various religious backgrounds, and because there seemed to be some biblical themes, I wondered if there was a Christian background for you or not. That's what I was probing to get at.
No, I've just always been intrigued with, you know, I've been intrigued with the Bible, and it has very unique elements, and it's definitely something so many readers can associate with. And to be honest, I think there's a lot of room for interpretation there. So it gives writers,
God.
Yeah. It gives writers a lot of fun to move forward. But I mean, like, as far as like church, I say, like, if you're going to say the good words, don't say them inside of a walls, you know, let them just keep going. You know, why give it a barrier? Just be good outside. Talk to everyone, be friendly, be a good person. Church seems, it's a good place. I think it's good for communities. I have nothing wrong with church, nothing wrong with religion, as long as it's based around love and honoring everybody and respect. Then I'm fine with it. It's like anything else. I'll be friends with anyone as long as they're a good person, they're respectful, and they're, you know, they're kind. But I just don't belong to any one religious belief, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, that resonates with me. I happen to join a church that is very open-minded, embraces the beliefs of many different religions, although it's primarily based on the teachings of Jesus. It just seemed to be a part of my spiritual evolution to return to a church setting. But I think the more important thing for me is, as you say, to lead the good life and to be kind and to practice qualities that I've emulated in other people that I would wish to possess for myself. What have been some of the challenges along the way for you during your life?
As far as just with writing or with just life in general?
Just with life in general.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to say, I look back and I've had a very calm, nice life. You know, when I worked in Yellowstone, that was a family tradition. My mother and father met there when they were young, and my sister worked there, and I just thought, you know, so I drove 1,200 miles, and my car literally died while I pulled into the parking lot. The alternator died as I pulled in.
Oh, gee.
Oh, no, the story gets fun. I'll just give you a fun story.
Okay.
Yeah, the part, because it's Yellowstone, took 3-4 weeks to get there. They finally fixed the car. My mom gives me the money. The day I get the car, I take it driving. No one went with me, because in Yellowstone, it's like three people have a car, and you either all get in or you're doing something else. So I was on my own. A brown blur runs in front of me. I think it was a squirrel. I swerved, flipped the car 3 times, and went upside down into a tree down a hill, right?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, seatbelt wasn't working across my chest. The airbag didn't deploy.
Oh, my God.
And yet I walked out of the car without a single scratch. And it was the tourists. The paramedic came down. I walked up the hill. They yelled at me and told me to lay down. I was laying there, and tourists were standing over me taking pictures.
And are you serious?
Said, yeah, yeah. But the guy got down next to me, and he said, "This is how I'm going to remember Yellowstone, as a place of miracles." And the paramedic said, "You should be dead. This is ridiculous. You should be dead." And
well,
that's
you
a
obviously
great
are.
Well, I mean, how could you not? I mean, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. I've looking back on stuff like that, all the challenges have been pretty worthwhile. I think it's been a pretty good life so far.
That's
a cool story. I thought that was really cool, you know?
I think it is. It's an amazing story, and it does speak of the fact that there are miracles. You know, when somebody seemingly should have been killed and to walk away without a scratch, that is amazing, absolutely amazing. Yeah. How long ago was that?
That was when I was 20 years old, and I'm 34 now. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. There's a lot of stuff that has to happen to get you to where you are right now. And I like where I'm at right now. You know, I mean, I'm going through the divorce, but I'm happy with the person I am right now. So that's good.
Well, I think that is so important for anybody if they're going to continue to grow and to enjoy their life. It's so important to be content with yourself and to be kind to yourself and kind to other people. What words of encouragement would you give to somebody that is interested in writing but just doesn't know where to begin?
Well, the first thing I'd say is just never give up, never stop. Because, I mean, if you're a real writer, you're going to write all the time. So the first book might not do anything, the second one might not do anything, but the third could be the best book ever written. You know, your style is always evolving. So never give up and keep trying. The first thing I would say, though, is just, you know, write something, get your name out there. You know, everyone has Facebook or Twitter. Actually, I don't really use Twitter. There's not enough character space.
No, right?
It's just not. You know, I always have to delete half of what I'm typing. You know, just start a blog, you know, just get your words out there and then start talking to people. Then they'll start reading your stuff and they can talk about it. And it's really just a snowball effect. You really have to start at the bottom. 3 years ago, I didn't even have a Facebook account. I was really the reclusive writer, and I really had to step out, which is tough for someone that's, you know, like I said, we're reclusive over the screenwriters. We're out there saying, hey, everyone, let's go to lunch. You know, it's luckily, I had a little bit of that on in there, so I got to step out. And that's the hardest part. You need to find a good comfort zone, and you have to be happy with who you are. Otherwise, how can you be successful if you're not going to sell yourself? So if you're going to be a writer, you need to like who you are, and you have to be proud of what you're doing. It's really hard to be a writer. I mean, if you can do that, then that right there is accomplishment. So every writer should just, before they even start, just say, that's awesome. And then start.
So, oh, I like that. That's
it's
good
hard.
Advice.
Mm-hmm. It's really hard to do what they do. Even if, you know, you find if you take your book to everyone and everyone hates it, and then a year from now this one person reads it and it changes their life, that made it all worthwhile. You just did something that was totally impressive, and that makes you immortal. That makes you your name will live on, and that is amazing. So every author should really be proud of themselves.
Well, here's the million-dollar question. What words of advice do you give to writers trying to sell themselves to an agent or a publisher?
For one thing, the worst thing I think is you want to be as little, you don't want to be, have any hint of an amateur. And that's really hard. There aren't enough query discussion groups out there to show you how to write a really good query. I would say just first off, understand the formula there. Go and, you know, write it, have it edited, have everybody read it before you even talk to an agent. And then when you find an agent you want to talk to, research the company, find out the books they've published, the authors they carry, maybe what conferences that agent goes to, some kind of common ground you can talk about. Then you need to take your book and find out how it relates to that agency. Do they have similar titles? What kind of market do you have? You have to go to them with all the cards so they'll say, yeah, we'll do as little work as possible to get your name out there. And that's when it's really tough, because a lot of people starting out, they don't have awards. They don't have tons of reviews. They're not listed in the New York Journal with this great review. So it's really difficult to stand out. I received my agent just off of my query letter, and luckily it read really well. And it's really hard to sell yourself in a paragraph. So my top advice would be work on the query letter. Just, it's a one-page resume for everything that you do as a writer, and it's really frustrating. Although I haven't done nonfiction, so I can only say this for fiction. I don't know what the process is on the other side. But, mm-hmm. Oy, the query letter, nightmare. And a synopsis, but a synopsis.
Well, Kevin,
is,
thank you so much. We've come to the end of the hour, and we've covered a lot of ground. It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I would love to have you back somewhere again down the line, and I'm so excited to have you working with me on my book, and I so appreciate your efforts on my behalf. And thank you for taking time to come on to the show tonight.
Oh, of course, I had a great time. I love the babble, so this is great.
Good. Well,
no, I didn't show up.
The one comment I wanted to make to you earlier in the interview was that I think you must be a keen observer of human nature, and I think that that plays heavily into being able to do character development and to even sort through something like a horror novel and to find humor in it, because life is full of absurdities. And so why not find humor in a horror novel?
Otherwise it's not real, right? See? It has to be realistic.
Well, thanks again. And I will talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.